This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The title of this installment is The Nature of Jewish Power. I'm going to continue with the same themes that I've been discussing for the last few podcasts about the Jewish problem and antisemitism. And just to summarize that idea, the main idea there is the transition from white rule to Jewish rule, from white power to Jewish power, is characterized by either the Jewish problem, when you see it from a white point of view, that transition, or it's characterized as anti-Semitism, when you see it from a Jewish point of view, or the Jews see it from a Jewish point of view, as resistance to Jewish rule. Now, in the previous discussion, the two sides, the names that I brought up were Abe Foxman and Jonathan Sachs. On the Jewish side, talking about anti-Semitism, and Wilhelm Marr on the German side from the distant past, 135-odd years ago, and his pamphlet. And what's interesting about both is that both sides talk about the conflict in terms of war. In terms of a conflict, in military terms, and on the Jewish side, it's actually in inhuman terms, where the enemy is a virus or a disease, and so isn't even in the same ballpark. Whereas Wilhelm Marr sees the Jews as a separate people, but as a people, and as I discussed, I thought his viewpoints were a little bit too favorable to Jews from my point of view, and not favorable enough to Germans. And they were a bit schizophrenic as well. And I want to call attention again to the thing that really set me off about Marr, that I really took issue with, which was his claim that we have been vanquished in open battle. Yes, in open battle, because Jewry has always shown its true face. And I want to go in this installment into more detail as to why that was so wrong. But I can start with Marr himself, who when I read it again, this is actually the third or the fourth time I read his pamphlet, I noticed that in the paragraphs just leading up to that statement, he actually lays out quite the opposite case, where he describes the weapons, and again, the military terms that he uses, that the Jews used included guile, which is a word for being clever or crafty, and astuteness, which is, it means a shrewdness or discernment, and especially when it comes to one's own concerns, which is a very apt word. I never appreciated the word astute in that sense before. I do now. But both of those kind of downplay how the Jews go about what they do, the nature of Jewish power. Describing it as guile and astuteness is neutral or even favorable to the Jews. And it contradicts, and this is my main point, is it contradicts the whole idea that the battle was an open battle. Now, there was a paragraph even after he claimed it was an open battle where he said from the very beginning it was not a religious war. It was a battle for survival against the foreign rule of Judaism. of whose character we only now have become clearly aware. And that's the point I made myself, was that prior to Mar, Europeans really didn't understand the nature of Jews and the nature of Jewish power and the Jewish problem. And we still don't. Europeans, for the most part, don't understand it. And whether it's 1 in 10 or 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000, if you stopped a random white person on the street and asked them, it's overwhelmingly the case that most white people have no clue what's going on with the Jews. They don't understand the Jews at all, much less that there's a war or the nature of it, the subtleties of it. So the claim that it's open war, I just wanted to take Mar to task again one more time over that issue, and not just to beat a dead horse, but to tie it in with what's going on today, which is that even amongst people who are racially conscious, I see this ignorance, really is probably the best word for it, whether it's willful ignorance by people who really aren't white or maybe sympathize with Jews, or if it's just ignorance because they don't want to think about it, they don't want to be called stupid, crazy, evil, or they don't think it's important, they underestimate the importance of it. There's a variety of causes, I think. Now, I've described it before as a stealthy war, and that's what comes out of this point I'm making here, that it's not open. It's the opposite of open. It's stealthy. It's a war by disguise and deception. But a key characteristic of and the nature of Jewish power is their willingness and their ability to organize, and the fact that they do organize and they do plan. And this, along with anti-Semitism, which I mentioned, came up a few weeks ago now when I was on with Carolyn Yeager and Hadding Scott. Toward the tail end of our discussion, we got a little bit into this issue about whether there's a conspiracy, whether there's a Jewish conspiracy. And I wanted to say a few words about that, because I think one of the ways that whites are discouraged from facing the reality of Jewish power and the war, the conflict between whites and Jews, is by the implication that you're crazy to imagine that there is such a thing, that there is such a conflict. And one of the ways that that is implied is that immediately people start making faces if you mention the Jews or Jewish power. They start assuming that, you know, this. They start talking about conspiracy theories and the Jews are, you think Jews are trying to control the world. Well, the fact is that Jews organize openly. They meet, they plan. Conspire has actually two meanings. The number one meaning is that making secret plans to jointly commit an unlawful or harmful act. Now, I could argue that because it's harmful to whites, even that meaning fits. But the second meaning of conspiracy or to conspire is a little looser, and it just means that joining or acting together, combining efforts towards some goal. That's a conspiracy. It doesn't have to necessarily be illegal. And a lot of what the Jews do in their own interests and against ours is perfectly legal to do. So it's not really about legality, but you can see the element there of harm. And the fact that it's harmful to whites is really something for whites to decide. Jews are not going to ever admit that they're causing harm to whites, unless it's painted as a good thing, that it was removing racists from power, which is exactly how they go about it. Now, another tactic that comes up whenever Jewish power is discussed is the Jews that are present, either overtly or covertly, try to shift the attention instead and shift the discussion instead to, well, how much power? And question just how much power Jews have. And they do it by trying to polarize the discussion. You know, of course, in Jewish minds, Jewish power is never sufficient. They can always think of 100 ways that Jewish power could be more complete. And that's one of the traits of Jews, and especially hyper-Jews, what I refer to as hyper-Jews. These Jews are essentially Jewish warriors, these people who are not only conscious of themselves as Jews, but are conscious of themselves as chauvinists for Jewish interests and actively go out and defend it. Jewish power is never complete enough in their mind, and so any mention of it, they try to mock by saying that it's Jews aren't very powerful. And then they also take the flip side. This is part of the polarizing, that they try to say, oh, you just think the Jews are all powerful and they have some sort of mind control rays and they can do everything. They're omnipotent. And what they're trying to do is exclude anything in between from being discussed. You know, they want either 0 or 100 to be discussed. And of course, 100 is absurd. And so they want everybody to just go back to ignoring Jewish power. And in the end, if they can't convince by that argument, well, they're willing to censor the argument too and just delete people's comments or shut down a forum or derail it entirely or illegalize it. And they work to do that as well. This is the point here is that this is a battle over perceptions. This war is not just a physical killing war. It's only a small part that it's like an iceberg. Most of it is just the war over perceptions, the cultural war, the war over ideas. And I described at the beginning of the podcast about the Jewish problem. I said, to sum it up in a single word about what the Jews are and what the Jewish problem is, I said the word is poison. And the nature of Jewish power is this war over ideas, and especially the spinning of poisonous ideas, the feeding of poisonous ideas to their enemies so that their enemies destroy themselves. These poisonous ideas are basically ideas that put an end to any people that is naive or stupid enough to adopt them. And we can see that in what's happening to the Western world today, in the United States, in England, in Sweden, in Germany. This, what's often described as liberalism, this idea that we have to be welcoming to the other and tolerant, and we have to combat hate and racism, which really just means putting aside our own interests and putting everybody else's interests above our own, and us meaning whites, of course, are the only ones who are really expected to do this. Now, this whole idea of shifting this tactic of shifting the conversation to how much Jewish power is really irrelevant in the end, because when we're talking about Jewish power and recognizing it as poisonous to whites, that it's harmful to whites, well, whether it's a little bit of harm or a lot of harm, it's harm. And it's something that whites have every right to object to and should object to. And that's really what Jews don't want you to do. And that's when they'll really start to squawk if you insist on coming back to that point. And that's when they'll start screaming anti-Semitism and you just want to rule the world so that you can kill all the Jews is the usual way that that accusation goes. But when you're talking about poison, even if it starts as a little bit, eventually it grows until it's fatal. And that certainly seems to be the trajectory that Jewish rule has throughout history, and certainly with our current civilization as it is right now. People use all sorts of metaphors, even the people who don't recognize the Jewish hand in it, the Jewish role. They talk about going off the cliff. They describe it as suicide. But everybody who is talking in politically incorrect, race-aware forums, even if they don't talk about Jews, realizes there's big problems. And that's part of the nature of Jewish power, is that so much of this discussion happens without ever mentioning the Jews. They talk about all of the peripheral symptoms, but not the Jews. Now, I can make a case, and I'll try and make it quick here, that Jews actually do have a lot of power. In fact, a lot of my blogging concerns this issue of calling attention to it. It's in the news all the time. Just in the last 6 to 9 months, there's been Chuck Hagel, the nominated for Defense Secretary of the United States, and it was really a big knockdown, drag-out fight between Jews. The Jews dominated the debate, both for and against, and what the debate in their minds was all about was whether Chuck Hagel was going to be good or bad for Israel. The Secretary of Defense of the United States, whether he was going to be the best man for the job for Israel, really. And then we had Joe Biden just last month, the Vice President of the United States, who was telling us that Jews have enormous media and cultural influence. He called it outsized and immense, and how that they had used that influence, that power, to push gay marriage, immigration, civil rights, feminism, all of these things bad for the white majority of the United States. Just today, or yesterday, Monday, I posted a blog post about the Forbes 400 and how 140 of the Forbes 400 richest Americans, about 35%, that is, are Jewish. And that in the Forbes global list of 1,426 billionaires, Forbes Israel estimated 11% Jewish, and a more objective blogger had estimated 17% Jewish. And this is financial power, which flows into all of these other, the media and the cultural influence that that Biden was talking about, and the political influence that we saw with Chuck Hagel. Now, the case that Jewish power is illegitimate is fairly easy to make as well. Legitimate is basically, when it comes to government, a government is legitimate if it has the consent of the people. If the people that are being governed don't consent and aren't aware of who's governing them, and especially if that ruling group is harmful to the people as a whole, well, then that rule is illegitimate. And probably the best evidence of that illegitimacy is these hyper-Jews who have reacted to some of these things, like the Biden thing and the Forbes thing, or at least when it came to Biden, there was Jonathan Chait, and in the case of the Forbes list, he wasn't reacting to Forbes. He was reacting to other lists of powerful or influential Jews, and that was Jeffrey Goldberg. But both of these hyper-Jews reacted in very similar ways. They didn't deny the power. What they did, though, is they basically listed the ways that it could be greater. They made a mockery of it. They joked about it, but in a nervous way. And there's a bit of cognitive dissonance there. They both pushed these buttons. They both used the words Nazi and anti-Semite, and they both pushed those buttons. And the cognitive dissonance comes from the conflict here, because those words, a lot of effort and money and media power has been invested in making those words be very serious and be applied to serious threats, sober attitudes. And yet these guys were mocking and laughing. And so there's a contradiction there. They want to laugh about the anti-Semites or laugh at the anti-Semites, their opposition to Jewish power. And at the same time, those words, those buttons have an effect because they've been drilled into people's heads that those things are bad. Either way, both of the whether you laugh at it or treat it as a really serious threat, both imply that the opposition or even just the criticism of Jewish power is illegitimate. They invert the reality. Instead of Jewish power being illegitimate, they try to make it out, and this is related to, like I said in the last installment, the Jews go on the attack. Instead of feeling defensive about something that they're doing wrong, they flip it around and blame you for doing it and being wrong. So the way they argue is from the basis in their minds that any criticism of Jewish power is what's illegitimate, not Jewish power. So as an example of the usual sober attitude toward anti-Semitism is the phrase combating anti-Semitism. And this is a phrase that occurs over and over and over again. Again, the military war connotations to the word combating anti-Semitism. The reality is that little code phrase means fighting to promote Jewish interests. It's an indication of the deceptive and fraudulent nature of Jewish power, is that the way they describe promoting Jewish interests is combating anti-Semitism. They flip it around. As Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks mentioned, Jews must never fight anti-Semitism alone. And he admitted that the fight against anti-Semitism, in Britain at least, was led by non-Jews and that it was in fact a government-led activity. In the United States, it's just as bad or worse. In the United States, we have the U.S. State Department fighting this fight. There's a special envoy created by a law in 2004 called the Global Anti-Semitism Review Act. This special envoy monitoring and combating anti-Semitism, as I say, it's a department within the U.S. Department of State in the U.S. government. And the key phrases are combating hate and promoting tolerance. And again, it's an Orwellian understanding of these words. You can't just go look up hate or tolerance in the dictionary and get the true sense of what these people are doing. It's actually about intolerance. It's about hating and combating anyone, and especially whites, that Jews perceive as resisting Jewish power, even just objecting to it verbally. That's anti-Semitism, and that's what they want to combat. And they want other people to do the fighting for them. Jews do a lot of the fighting, a lot of the organizing, and a lot of the talking and a lot of the thinking. They create the ideas and the phrases, but they want other people to do the fighting and the dying and the paying for the fighting to the extent that they can get other people to do it. They war by proxy. Now, the current special envoy was just named last month to the position. He's either the third or the fourth. I don't know exactly which. But his name is Ira Foreman, and he led the National Jewish Democratic Council for 15 years. This is a partisan political organization in the United States that, according to its About page, educates Democratic, meaning the Democratic Party, elected officials and candidates to increase support for Jewish domestic and foreign policy priorities. So they're pretty upfront about what they're organizing to do. And we do this to promote both social justice in America and a secure democratic Jewish state of Israel. They brag about their works, that they're on the offensive, and that their persuasion work is reflected every day in the media. Now, the most recent event that this special envoy did, he's already done a few things, but the most recent thing up on the website is titled Stemming the Tide, Confronting the Rise of Global Antisemitism. And it's a presentation he gave on June 4th to the American Jewish Committee Global Forum in Washington, D.C. And I'm just going to skip and hit a few of the high points here. He describes the American Jewish Committee that he's talking to as a group which is dedicated to combating antisemitism, which is, you know, just another group. I mean, there's all of these groups, the NJDC, the special envoy himself, the American Jewish Committee. That's what Jewish organizations do. They're combating anti-Semitism is a code word for promoting Jewish interests. Also fair treatment for the state of Israel. Well, it's not really fair. What they want is special treatment for the state of Israel. They describe it as fair because in their minds, it's only fair to treat Israel specially. And he goes on to describe the way that they're going to do this, the way that they're going to achieve their goals is they're going to support efforts to combat hate and promote tolerance in the world. Our strategy is to confront and combat hatred in all its ugly forms, whether it is hatred directed against people on account of their religion, ethnicity, race, sexual orientation, or differences of political opinion, or due to their country of origin. Antisemitism is a widespread form of such hatred. So right there, they tie all of those other things together. If you thought that it was some high-minded set of principles that we are not going to discriminate based on religion, ethnicity, and all the rest, and that that was something that applied equally to everybody, well, what these guys are telling you in their published paper on U.S. government website is that it's all about defending the Jews. It's all about promoting the best interests that Jews think are in their best interests, are promoting the values in their best interests, promoting tolerance, acceptance, and compassion of Jews. They, a little later on, he's talking, and this is where the contradiction comes up, the most noticeable contradiction. He talks about the misplaced concern, the threats to the Jewish way of life, and motivated by genuine but misplaced concerns about children's rights. And he's talking about the laws against circumcision in some countries in Europe. And it's interesting, of course, the way that he describes it as a threat to the Jewish way of life. It's these European countries, of course, are passing these laws because of the threat they perceive to their way of life. But, of course, from a Jewish point of view, it's always about what's best for the Jews. He talks also, and I'll probably get into this in another podcast, about this conflict between freedom of religion and freedom of expression, the freedom of people to express their religious beliefs, but at the same time, the freedom of other people to criticize those. And he talks about objections. He wants governments in the world to make clear their objections to speech that promotes intolerance. So, you know, free speech with the exceptions for intolerance, and intolerance is whatever the Jews decide is intolerance. Now, here's the key paragraph. Nationalistic movements target immigrants and religious and ethnic minorities in the name of protecting the identity and purity of their nation. And he writes purity in quotes. And the first thing I think of there is, what about Israel? We just heard the National Jewish Democratic Council is all for the Jewish state of Israel, the purity of Israel as a Jewish nation and as a Jewish state. Well, of course, they're not talking about Israel. They're talking about everybody else's nationalistic movements and the threat to Jews in those countries. See, Jews don't just want a country to themselves. They have that. They also want to be free to live in every other country, and not just live in every other country, but climb into the highest positions of power and tell those people how to live their lives, how to fight anti-Semitism. The truth is that Jewish power is based on lies and fraud, and they wage war by proxy, and that's how they do it. They have their country, and they want your country to fight for their best interests as well. And they actually get it to happen. They get it to happen in Britain. They get it to happen in the United States, and they use those countries to go around the world and express their influence, express their power. You're right.